Just call this meeting to order. Want to approve the minutes? Seems like these are all of them we're going to approve. Which ones?
Yeah.
Those three.
Six and seven.
Representative Ruth, did you read the minutes from the 5th, 6th, and 7th?
Oh, definitely.
Would you like to move those?
I would move those, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. First bill is Representative Seifert. Do you want to... Members, we didn't have in our possession Representative Tinglestead's bill 2212. We have it today, so I think we have to remove that for possible inclusion. Any questions about that? We did hear it, and we did move it, but we didn't have it, so we got to do it again.
We got to remove it.
We got to remove it.
Sort of.
So I will move House File 2212 for possible inclusion. Now, I'm going to spell all in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Okay, now we have Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, if I could have it laid over. Mr. Chairman, good morning, and members. This is a bill that came out of the Health Policy and Finance Committee. It would request that a report be given to the legislature every year on where people have been coming from and where they've resided in the previous 12 months. And this would be at any given time in the 12 months, so it's not requiring if someone's moved four times that you have to track all this. Too much work, and the author's intention is not that. But for those six programs that you see listed on lines 14 through 19, just so people have an idea of, you know, is Minnesota's had this reputation on purpose or by accident, at least in my part of the state, where people have either bad information or good information or anecdotal information that we have a lot of folks moving into the state to take advantage of public assistance programs. And unless we have the information and the data is correct from a nonpartisan source, I don't know that I want to believe that that Minnesota is a welfare magnet state, if you will. And so what this would do is just give the legislature the information so the policymakers can analyze it every year. And if they want to make any changes in policy accordingly, fine. And if not, that's fine, too. We tried waiting periods some years ago, and the courts threw them out. So that one, is the policy change, is probably off the table unless you want to try it again and take a test run with a different court, makeup of court. But the department can run this information. Some of the programs are dependent on the Health Match program getting fully implemented. I have two people from the department here. If members have questions on current information, when we were in the Health Committee last week, they didn't have it at their fingertips, but they did get some information on, like, MFEP available. If anybody would like to kind of ask a question, they're available.
Any questions from the membership?
Sure.
Representative Clark, are you raising your hand?
I was, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna
move it, Bill.
Thank you. Representative Tebbett, I would like to ask the department maybe a couple questions. If you're here, we might as well make the day worthwhile, huh?
Position.
I guess I'm, whichever one of you would be willing to answer. First of all, how much is this really going to cost us? I see the fiscal note here is, wow, is it $1.8 million? Is that right? Am I reading that wrong?
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Kim Carlin from the Department of Human Services. The fiscal note is showing some costs related to the current MATSA system. And then there is our costs associated with Health Match. Those are costs that would be incurred at this time if the system was changed now during the design phase to accommodate this report. If the report or the effective date of when you want the report is after Health Match is implemented, the cost would be dramatically less.
I think the answer to my question is yes. Right, that it's 1.8.
Yes,
is that right? And maybe Ms. Sessions want to say something else?
The amendment that we did, this is, I believe. Could that be the new one? There's 1 point something going on. A housing finance, that's what it was. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Ann Sessions of the Department of Human Services. I need to say that when we, when the bill was presented in the health, there was discussion about changing the exact language in the bill so that we would not be required to record all of the locations the individuals had been in the prior 12 months. And that amendment, I mean, no language has gone to change that, but some of the discussions and the data we have is based on what data is in our computer system versus what would be in the computer system if we had to follow the language in the bill.
Okay, so the fiscal note is $661,000?
If Mr. Chairman, the preliminary fiscal note is that we had discussions, I believe Representative Wilkin was there, that the fiscal note could credibly come down to zero, I believe, if we do it after the health match program. And they have, the department is working for language, that's why we're having it laid over, is working on language to make that work. We can put the effective date out next year and put, or when the health match program is implemented, whichever is later, and that would take the fiscal note down. So I'll try to get the language to the committee at some point. There'd be a small fiscal note, they think.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, since this is a fiscal committee, it seems like we should have that information soon because if I'm reading the fiscal analysis here, it could cost us $889,000 per month of delay for Health Match if this were in effect. It's a lot of money every month, and why in the world would we do that? I'm not sure. Well, first of all, is that correct? Is that fiscal comment correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. Right now, the fiscal note is at $661,350, which represents the state share, and that is based on how the bill is written right now, asking for 12 months of residency information. Once Health Match goes up, and if the bill is amended as we understand it would be, there would be a small cost involved in collecting information about medical assistance recipients who currently do not have a residency requirement. So the system is not designed to collect that information.
Ms. Sherman? Somebody's talking to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the goal is to collect information for policymakers to make a decision on are we a welfare magnet state or not. And I'm just going to cut to the chase on the commentary here because I have two other bills up. I have people in my part of the state that are saying Minnesota is overly generous in the benefits it gives out, and we're attracting people from across the border in South Dakota. And all the anecdotal evidence that goes with it. I think it would be helpful for the legislature to have the information. The department does have some information preliminarily at no cost that they were able to find just in the last week for me since we're in the jobs committee on Thursday, actually, on MFEP and by state, where folks are coming from that have not had Minnesota residency in the prior 12 months.
Mr. Chair? I've been around here a long time, and every time you or anybody else has tried to use information, I guess you just told me what the information is for, I believe you did, which is to try to restrict people who would be coming into the state to be eligible for public assistance of some sort, whether it's, prenatal care, and when you thought of it, whether or not you know, residents should be able to have prenatal care for their babies and so on. But so is your, if your goal is that, is that correct? The goal is to try to restrict future use of some of these public assistance programs, medical care and so on, to residents that you might decide are unworthy because they haven't been here long enough. Is that kind of what your goal is?
Mr. Chairman, my goal is that Minnesota taxpayers take care of Minnesotans. And if we have, I'm not sure what the percentage is, but I think there's some preliminary estimates that it's around 14% minimally on average. But I think there's some particular programs where the average is much higher, where people are coming in from all over the place. And if our budget is growing in the health and human services area by, if our forecast goes up and we have $1.9 billion of new money, and $1.2 of it is going out the door to health and human services before we do any changes of law, that fiscally will not work. We will go bankrupt. And when you have more people riding on the wagon and fewer people pulling it, it doesn't work economically. I know we have a philosophical disagreement on that. That's what the legislature is all about. But in my opinion, fiscal sanity dictates that we can't have thousands and thousands and thousands of people moving to the state of Minnesota every year to take advantage of a pie that's not growing fast enough to accommodate all the growth. Now, I know that sounds impolite or whatever, but that's the reality of it, is we are a small to mid-sized state, and if we have extremely generous benefits, people are going to move here. I don't know how to deal with it because I'm not in this committee. I'm not in Representative Bradley's committee. But at some point, we have to deal with the issue. And if I remember right, the residency waiting requirements passed the legislature when it was DFL-controlled.
Mr. Chair,
by a very large margin. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but if I'm not mistaken, in the 1990s, the body was not controlled by Republicans or the Senate.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I'm not making this a partisan issue, but it is a constitutional issue, and I think you know, Representative Clark, but I guess I'd like to know, you can tell us, I think we've passed, or attempted to pass, residency requirements, I don't know, since I've been here 3, 4, 5 times maybe, and every time it's gone unconstitutional to tell people that they can't cross the border in this United States of America to get a job, to try to better their life, and if they have a situation where they need health care or they need some other sort of public assistance, it's unconstitutional that, you know, just to have a border block. And so that costs us millions of dollars, and I'm wondering if you can tell me, and it seems, I'm not calling it partisan, but I am calling it political. Why would this be coming forward? I think what you're appealing to is something that we found over and over and over. I can say 4 or 5 times since I've been here and probably the chairman too. It's unconstitutional. And why would we collect this information for something that is unconstitutional? To collect it for some other purpose, I think the health match, is separate. We don't need this legislation to pass for health match to work. In fact, it delays health match and causes its problems. But how much, can you tell me, have you researched how much it costs, you know, for Minnesota to have this contested in the courts each of the, you know, many times that it's had to go to court?
Representative Clark, the bill is not to institute waiting periods. It's just asking for information. And if we're afraid of information as legislators, we might as well pack it up and go home right now. Because it doesn't deal with that. It doesn't deal with restricting anyone to get a program. It's not dealing with anyone to have to go through a waiting period or to not cross the border.
Mr.
If that were in the legislation, we could talk about that, but that's not in the legislation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
I asked you what your purpose was. We have many priorities in this community. We have kids who can't, whose health, whose educational and training programs are being cut in this committee. We have all kinds of folks who are here before us asking for help. And if we're going to collect information solely at this point in time, I mean, mostly or whatever, your reason appears to be, and that's why I asked you very carefully, the reasoning behind collecting this has a goal of restricting something that's been found to be unconstitutional. That's a waste of this committee's money. I would rather spend it on the things that we're going to have to be deciding in the next week or so, you know, that really are urgent. And this is something, you know, it's unconstitutional, your goal. So the information is not anything to be afraid of. Let's do it when we have a little more money on the table.
Representative Wilkins.
Yeah, thank you. To that point, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the bill doesn't have any unconstitutional goals. There's many things we can do with the information that Representative Seifert is trying to gather in this study. We do a ton of studies around here, especially in an area where it's fairly controversial on whether, you know, whether and to what extent the welfare magnet thing is happening or not. It's not necessarily just whether you have an eligibility based on the period of time you're here. It's also whether our benefits are just so generous that they're attracting people here because they're more generous than other states. I think that's a real issue you should be concerned about, because as more and more people come to this state to get on our welfare system and to sop up all the benefits that we offer, those systems are going to collapse. And Representative Bradley is struggling in his committee with 27% growth in some of the forecasted health care programs, 18% growth in other programs. How do you sustain that if you don't clamp down and figure out how to make it so that Minnesota isn't a welfare magnet? We'll do this argument all day, and it'll pass by a wide margin if we do something about it, I guarantee you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Quack, we won't do it all day, I promise.
Thank you. I guess, Representative Quack, are you talking about welfare for who? In this last couple committee meetings, we've been talking about wage subsidies, we've been talking about tax benefits for all kinds of corporate interests, you know, that want us to give them money. Are we attracting those, those corporate sluggish, whatever you want to call them? I mean, are we, you know, the people who come here hopefully are coming to have a better life, and I hope you wouldn't want to deny them that. But my only point was, we don't have a lot of money to spend, and I think what's being talked about here, the goal of what's being talked about, maybe by the author, is something that's unconstitutional, and I just don't know if we have money like that right now. So, I didn't get an answer, Representative Sophia. How much does it cost for the state to deal with an unconstitutional challenge to what you actually want this information to be used for? How much does it cost?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I mean, that's not the bill. I'm not going to answer the question because the bill is not, that's not the bill. The bill is not to institute waiting periods. I don't have that bill. I doubt that anyone's going to have it this year. So I just, you know, it's up to the Attorney General. He's got a lot of time to go after a lot of other things, but it's whatever the Attorney General is going to have to assume on it. But that's not the bill. That's not the issue.
Mr. Chairman, my last point then would be, I would like the department to come back and give us that information. You can get it for us. Maybe you know. If you do know, I'd like to. Do you know right now what the cost of any of those lawsuits have been? Ms. Essence, do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I know that on the last residency lawsuit, the Attorney General costs are not part of, they're in our base, what we have to pay for our Attorney General fees. But our costs for legal aid were $130,000, I believe. Excuse me. Can I take a moment to say, though, that we do have some residency provisions in law now. There are some programs where individuals cannot receive benefits for the first 30 days that they come to Minnesota. And so what was found unconstitutional was the extension of that beyond the 30 days paying at the rate of the lower state. And we have some of the information that Representative Seifert seems interested in getting on our computer system now, and that's what we're working on a report with him too.
So maybe a final question. When will we get that information about whether or not we actually need this bill or not, because a lot of the data is apparently there?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe within a couple days, I need to confirm some of the numbers because I had it done in the last 2 days, and then we were going to send it to the representative.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the Attorney General has so much time because he has so many targets of opportunity. But, Mr. Chair, my question to you, Bill, Representative Seifert, is... we're collecting information in this bill about people coming here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could make it a big political discussion. I'm not going to try to get to that particular point. I think some of the underlying reasons is that all those people in those coffee shops that you're worried about having to pay an extra tax or have an inspection are talking about a welfare state. Well, you know, I've got friends around the country, and just about every state's a welfare magnet, unfortunately. It's a common misconception. My concern, though, with your bill is you're collecting information about people coming. Are we going to be able to see the number of people leaving with the same information?
Ms. Sessions.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would know that we close cases, but we often don't have contact with individuals to know where they go.
Mr. Chair, if this bill gets included in our omnibus bill, I would certainly hope that Representative Seifert or somehow or another we include language that at the same time that this is presented, that we also try to figure out how many people are leaving the welfare rolls. So we kind of figure out, are we doing a net gain, are we doing a net loss, or is it kind of a wash? Because I think that's important. That's an important part of it. If we're going to do policy, we need to have all three sides of that particular one.
Representative Mahoney, if it makes it there, you'll have a chance to put that amendment in markup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gazilka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin addressed most of my comments, but I'll just make one comment to Representative Seifert. as a legislator, I want to be able to make the best decisions I can on any issue, and to do that, I've got to have the facts. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward. I think we're asking for difficult information. It could result in difficult decisions, but I want to know that I have the reason behind why we do the things we do. And so I don't know where this information is going to go, but because we've never done this before. Is that correct? And if not, I think we should have that information.
Representative Steinke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gazalka, I don't believe we've had a full report like this done. I think there's maybe been some things inside the department where the little gleaned information has come out. But I guess if the department does have some preliminary information for the first 3 months of 05, I believe, what I'm going to try to do is if they can aggregate the data for the calendar year 04, I know that'll be a lot more work, but if they can at least get it for some of the programs, doesn't have to be for everything, but I think that gives us a one-year snapshot at least of what's going on. And then I would be happy to compile it and send it to each legislator to make decisions based upon what they see. And I don't know what a lot of the information is. That's why it'd be nice to know when you go to the coffee shop and say, well, it's only 3%, it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is it's probably going to be a little more than that. I don't know. We'll see what the department comes up with. But if we could do calendar year 04, I think that would at least give people some thought process on what it could be.
Yeah.
Is hard to come by sometimes, but I think the department is doing a pretty good job of coming up with some things.
Representative Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd say at the very minimum we get it for our committee. I'd appreciate that. Get it as soon as we can.
One person. Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I think we've got enough to do today. I mean, let me just tell you, as somebody who's been in this field and tries to make decisions, as Representative Gazelle just said, on good facts, I consider this very important, and this has been important as a bipartisan issue way back on the constitutional issues. We've only kind of touched the edges, really. I mean, I think we better understand, because I think we went into the last time not sort of having a sense of what might be the constitutional issues. There are many, many, many ways that one crafts public policy, but let's do it based on fact, and then we can address the, if there is going to be constitutional issues, we can address it a little more informed. Makes sense to me.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, people are interested in collecting data. Representative Wilkin, I have two bills in your committee to try to understand, to track facts, information about outsourcing the jobs, and you haven't given me a hearing this year. That would have come to this committee, Mr. Chairman, and has everything to do with this committee. You know, that's with jobs. You know, what happens when people lose their job? You know, do they stay in Minnesota? Do they go to another state? What happens? Do they go on the welfare rolls? You have a lot of people laid off in your district, I think, or some people affected by the alien strike. There were all kinds of alien impact with the 911. There were lots of kinds of issues like that in probably every one of our district. You know, and we have companies that are picking up and leaving. Yesterday, we were trying to look at a long-term Minnesota industry that needs some help. I mean, there are reasons that bill was before you to collect data on outsourcing jobs, and I don't know why you didn't give me a hearing. It's certainly just as valuable as trying to track what we're talking about here today. Don't you think, Representative Wilkin?
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I think if you put it to a vote of the legislature, I think people would be a lot more interested in Representative Seifert's the data gathered by that than the other. I mean, I didn't hear a real broad-based support clamoring for a study on the bills you had in.
Mr. Chairman, outsourcing was not an important issue in this last election.
I don't think that that was what that was getting at. You were talking about moving around within the state. I think it was based on job zones, maybe.
Mr. Chairman, it was. I wanted to look at. Well, you didn't give me a chance. You didn't give me a chance to even have a hearing so we could talk about it. I mean, that's the main problem, I guess. But you know, for whatever reason you deny that, maybe you'll consider it next year. Because I think if you're really committed to information gathering, let's find out what's going on with these jobs being outsourced.
Representative Wilkins, you going to move this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll move House File 932 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Very well. Representative Sipich. I'm sorry.
All right, Mallory. I'll let that go. Representative Seifert, it's interesting that we'll be collecting this data. And you call me his name, and then he doesn't even listen to me, so that's all right. I'm going to pass for now. I'll just know that there's going to be quite a few amendments if this gets added on to collect some more data on how many people actually went to medical assistance and such when they got kicked off of Minnesota Care. We could have a big fact-finding mission on the effects of the last budget go-around and the effects to social services on that level. It's interesting we'll be collecting data during a downturn in the economy, too, which is going to have a direct effect on the data we get on this. So, Mr. Chair, just if we're marking up the bill, this study is going to get very huge if I have my say about it on what data we collect and some of the decisions that were made by the majority parties in the last go-around.
We'll look forward to it. Representative, any other questions on this bill? Representative Wilkins renews his motion to have House File 932 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Nope. No.
Motion carries. Representative Mahoney. Okay. I believe your motion is to have this sent to Ways and Means Committee, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very well.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House File 400 is a bill in a fashion that we've seen, I think, every couple of years for the last two or three sessions anyhow. It concerns school kitchen workers, food service workers. I knew I couldn't think real straight this early in the morning. And their ability to collect unemployment during the summer when they can't get another job. This has been through a couple of committees. We're trying. I'd like to turn it over to Don Gertesmeyer from the Teamsters and let him explain the bill, explain the good reason why this is a necessary bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gertesmeyer.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Don Gertesmeyer, and I work for the Minnesota Teamsters. Before you is a bill that we've been working on and off since 1999. And we were given a history compiled by the department showing how this progressed through from 83 to 99. These are private sector employers, by the way, employees and employer. These are not public sector school employees. They've been doing this work for some 30-odd years. The previous employer was Signature Dining. And from 83 to 99, these people received unemployment as long as their employer didn't object. In 99, I'm not quite sure why, but that legislation kind of tipped over and said that I think it got caught up in the public school employee provisions, and they were no longer eligible after 99. So we worked with the department that year to try and get ready to change this statute. And in 2000, that session law changed with a two-year sunset. So we were back to see you in 2002 and went through the same issues and got another session law, with a two-year sunset through 2004. Last year, we came down to see if we couldn't change the statute and got caught up in all of the session-ending stuff, and it collapsed. And so, at effective December 4th of 2004, these people are no longer eligible for unemployment. I want to remind you again, these are private sector employees working for a private sector employer. Everybody pays unemployment tax. The employer is not here. This is the third hearing protesting these changes. These people, there are a handful of full-time people that want to return this payment or need it for the safety of our children and the school lunch program. I'm rested mostly part-time, and nobody's protesting this unemployment. Most of them can't get another job because they know in anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks they're going to be returning to the school system. So I think there's even some legal stuff involved if we were to say, no, private sector people that pay the taxes can't have unemployment. So I'm asking you so that we don't have to come back every year or two to help us change the statute. These are private sector employees and a private sector employer. An employer is not here protesting this. This is the third committee, and in a bipartisan effort on everybody's part, it has passed previous House committee and Senate committee unanimously. So I'd ask for your support this morning so that we don't have to come back every 2 years to bother you with this. I take any questions.
And Mr. Chair, the Department of Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the department is in support of this particular bill. They're here in case there's questions that Mr. Grossmeyer and myself can't handle, but and they'll come down and testify, but I know our agenda is full. So,
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarification, Mr. Grossmeyer, you said private sector. I happen to have wife who works in this, and I work actually for the school system, so it's taxpayer funded. I mean, I just want to, just as a terminology, aren't these not school employees?
No. No, they work for Tahoe International. He sends them wherever he needs them.
I'm sorry.
And the other thing is, there is a fiscal note. I dropped off for you the packet on Friday, and then another one this morning. There is a fiscal note from the department. That's how it got to this committee. And it shows that there's basically little impact on the fund.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, I mean, the situation that I'm thinking about school employees are working for, you're talking about a specific group then. Could you sort of just quickly educate me what specific group you're speaking to?
These employees are in the North Branch school system and in the Chaska and Norwood Young America, these teamsters that we're talking about. There's about 125 to 150 people involved. And I've got some questions about privatization or outsourcing. Again, this is about, I think, coming up on 30 years that Signature Dining before Tahoe now has held this contract. So this is nothing new.
Any other questions on House File 400? Seeing none, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 400 passed and go to Ways and Means Committee. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Thank you, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tao.
You going to move this over?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sertich.
Right, Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 1741 for possible inclusion.
Very well.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's a pretty straightforward bill. Just to increase the GRH rate for Teen Challenge up to $700 per bed, 451 beds. Many of you on the committee already sort of know what Teen Challenge does. I actually been to the facility, and I think this is probably some of the best investment the state can make, because I believe many of the patients the Teen Challenge work with potentially or have already come from prison. So we're saving a lot of money by having them go through Teen Challenge. And Rich Sherber here will talk a little bit about Teen Challenge.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Rich Sherber. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Teen Challenge. Let me start this morning by saying a thank you for the opportunity to come and present For those who are not aware of our program is really a misnomer. The name Teen Challenge represents, we're part of a network of over 172 teen challenges across America, over 230 teen challenges outside the U.S. border. Most of Teen Challenge programs are not teenage programs, they're adult facilities. In Minneapolis, we have about 300 residents, we have about 50 teens and the balance are adults. We're one of the longest, the only long-term residential programs helping chronic inebriates that I'm aware of in the state of Minnesota. Most treatment models are 28 days or 60 days, and right now over 62% of our population are meth addicts. We are receiving a minimum of 40 calls a day into our admissions office, most of them coming from meth addicts, because the relapse of methamphetamine, 3 weeks of treatment for meth addiction is too short of time. We have very strong bipartisan support. We had our banquet on Friday night. We had over 2,000 people at the downtown Hilton. We have the Attorney General there endorsing the program, Congressman Oberstar, as well as Amy Klobuchar spoke that night, and there were over 30 state legislators. We have very strong bipartisan, as well as the Speaker of the House. We are probably one of the most successful, we are the most successful drug rehabilitation program. We'll match our data with anybody, treatment program. We are basically, we have 50 years of history. There's been many studies that have been done nationally on Teen Challenge. Every study that I'm aware of have shown over 70% success. A government study recently showed over 86% of people completed Teen Challenge were drug-free. Another study done by Northwestern University 3 years ago showed 86% of people completed Teen Challenge were drug-free. Our funding source, 75% of our funding is private dollars, 25% is government funding. There is no funding component for long-term drug treatment. So basically, we use group residential housing for those enrolled in our one-year program. Just so you get an idea, I got this data, I've got it with me if anybody wants to see it. A memo recently sent out by Dennis Benson in the Department of Corrections that cited the information he got from Department of Human Services. The average 28-day programs, I'm not sure if this is nationally or locally, is $11,840 for treatment. Let me say that again, that's $12,000 for the average treatment model. You've got other programs in Minnesota, they're costing over $23,000 to $24,000 a month. The only funding we're getting right now for our one-year program is the $692 through GRH. There's two levels of funding for GRH. There's one level which is called a base rate, and then there's one GRH rate that has a rate with supplemental services. Some of you that are aware of our program know that we're not only doing the supplemental service component of GRH, which I have a copy of that. We're doing everything that a licensed drug treatment program is doing. As a matter of fact, we have a licensed drug treatment program, a 60-day extended program, that the people who are not in that 60-day program do the exact same. This is the biggest bang for the buck that I know that the state of Minnesota can get. Where can you get treatment for $692? And what's happening right now with our program is that our program has grown. Just so you get an idea, our cost to run our program is $2,200 a month. Of that, we were able to get a rate increase on some of the supplemental beds. And the reason I've got in front of me, there's 13 Hennepin County what we call level four facilities or GRH facilities that provide supplemental services. And all of these 13 programs, a good portion of these are inebriate housing facilities. That means they're GRH facilities that you can come and you can basically they're facilities for chronic addicts. Every one of them is getting, here's every one of them, $1,400, $1,400, $1,400, $1,400, $1,400. I won't mention all of them. Then you come down to Teen Challenge, but the county has licensed us as a level four, the high level GRH facility, because we do everything, we do all the supplemental services, and We run it almost like a licensed program. They don't know what to do with us because we're not just a little board and lodge. And so they've licensed us. We're the only one out of the whole 13. Here's our rate, $692. And the bottom line is this, that this was about 5 months ago. We had 236 people in the 1 year, the adults in the 1 year residential facility. Our cost, $2,200 a month. When you add the GLH facility, we're going to get a rate increase of $100 several years ago on some of the bids. But make a long story short, we're supplementing every resident in the program. Don, you're here in a minute here, or Jeff. We supplement all of them. Right now it's up over 250 adults at $1,400 a month. At the 236 residents that we had several months ago times $1,400, that means $341,000 worth of donations. $341,000 worth of donations have to come every month. And let me tell you just the way it is. We're a bunch of softies. Yesterday we took 9 people in our program. And any one of them, I'll tell you, if you would have seen them, you would have poured your hearts out. These are people who are dying. Bottom line, they got nowhere to go, and this is not inebriate housing where we'll say, come, and Don here will tell you, before he came in, the county said, nah, well, there's no more treatment for you. This guy's been through 44 treatment programs. We're going to put you in inebriate housing. You're going to drink yourself to death. And we're saying, no, you're not going to die. You come over here in 12 months, we'll get you back healthy, we'll get you, and those of you who visit our program know it's working. We have a very high success rate. We're not a bunch of enablers. This is the hardest program any human being can do, and we're getting them back on their feet. We need your help. I've taken in 65 new adult residents in this last year, and we're looking. We've added several new facilities this year. We're looking at adding, probably, we're just starting a teen challenge in Duluth. If I don't get some funding, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I've just asked two guys to come with me very quickly. Don can share in 1 minute his story, and then Jeff, you can share yours, and then we'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Would you please give your name to the record?
Yeah, my name is Donald, and I'm 44 years old. Teen Challenge is my 44th treatment program. I have 35 years of active drug use. I was a leader of a high-ranking member, anyway, of a notorious street gang, the Gangster Disciples. I've been to every prison in Minnesota minus two at least twice. If you looked at my record, you'd say I was a monster. I know I would. But the truth of the matter is I'm sick. I'm an addict. My crimes are directly related to my addiction. I have a bachelor's degree and I want to work. And I tried a teen challenge to accept me into their program. The state told me they would not support it financially. But they would support me going to Plymouth to this inebriate house where I know, because I've been there, you can do all the drugs you want as long as you're backed by curfew. I've been in teen challenge for 8 months. After 30 days, my kidneys collapsed. I now am on dialysis 3 days a week, 4 hours a session. And Teen Challenge has been very supportive and what I'm going through. And we need cases like Teen Challenge. Thank you.
Representative Bradley, you have a question?
Finish the testimony. My name is Jeff Langford. I'm 36 years old. I've been in the program 9 months. Been arrested 3 times for manufacturing methamphetamines. I got 4 fifth-degree controlled substances. I'm probably the biggest deferred sentence to Minnesota Teen Challenge. They wanted to give me 22 years in prison. They stayed 127 months over my head and allowed me to come into the program. I had to go back to prison and finish my old sentence, as I've been in every institution in Minnesota. I've got 20 years of meth addiction, 10 years of manufacturing methamphetamines. I was not a big drug seller. I mainly just, I farmed. I had a 10,000 acre farm in northern Minnesota that I rented from a guy out of Kansas, and I farmed and had trucks. I got involved in methamphetamines through driving truck.
I took my first pill of speed when I was 10 years old. My dad had a trucking company. I was involved in drugs all my entire life. You know, I kind of functioned until the last 10 years. The last 10 years, I was just basically just killing myself. I'd probably shove a needle in my arm 15 times a day. I'm probably one of the worst addicts that Teen Challenge has seen yet. When they arrested me, I was about 120 pounds lighter than I am now. That was February 20th of 2003. I was dying. The officer said that I was, one of the officers said his grandfather looked better 3 days dead in the coffin than I did the day they picked me up. Teen Challenge has given me a life. I have hope now. I've been through, boot camp in prison. I've been through triad. I've been through all the treatment programs. And this is the only one that's gave me any hope. I lived 35 years without the Lord, and, if you'd have told me 2 years ago I'd be sitting here now, I'd have told you he was crazy. You know, I thought I was lost in my addiction forever, and they've gave me hope, and it's just a great place to be. Thanks.
Can I just say one more thing? Presently, over half of our adults coming in the program are diversion. We're the largest diversion program. If these people weren't with us, over half of our adults would be in prison. So there is a substantial savings there versus incarceration, and not even including the treatment component.
Thank you. Representative Bradley?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Every encounter that I have with Teen Challenge is a bit of emotion because I compliment the testifiers today, but behind them are hundreds of stories that in all respects are the same kind of story. Once in a while we have issues come before us where party affiliation doesn't mean a darn thing, thank goodness. This is one where I think that we all come together. I recall years ago getting in a battle, and it was Representative Skoglund was the suitable lead on the other side, where we were denying some funding because it was kind of some, well, these people aren't qualified by the kind of licensing that we have, which for something that is so significantly more effective, it was kind of a strange thing. But it is good that we all come together. Representative Tao, thank you for bringing this bill to us. Now if I can sort of switch gears to kind of a practical, looking at the fiscal note, it says that it would increase your current GRA supplemental service rate of $203.97 to $700. And that doesn't sort of fit, right? Because I think, Mr. Chair, you said something about being $690-something.
Well, we get, we're presently getting... we were able to get a rate increase. I think the average is about $750 for GRH, and I think what this would do is bring us up to where the other GRH facilities are with supplemental services. So the other 13 that are getting $1,400 a month, it would bring us up to that level where we would get we would get the fees that the other level 4 GRH facilities put.
Mr. Chair, and maybe this is just for follow-up because I want to make very sure. I mean, I'm certainly enthused, and I think I hope all of us around the table are enthused to try to provide this help because it's so desperately needed. But I don't know if someone can speak to the fiscal note is what I'm looking at, and I'm a little confused of it compared to what Mr. Schreiber is saying. Is someone that can speak to this a little bit?
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dwayne Elg. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I work with the Group Residential Housing Program. The fiscal note that you're looking at represents an increase in the supplemental service rate of Group Residential Housing. There are a few different rates that come with this program. The base rate, the 692 that Rich Sherber spoke to, is the room and board rate. The rate increase applies to the supplemental service rate, and that just pays for services for people who are not eligible for services under any of our MA based programs. So he's getting $203 in addition to his current $692, and he is looking to increase that $203 to $700 in addition to the $692.
And Mr. Chairman, that helps a lot. I think it's the combination of those two then that comes to approximately the $1,400 you were speaking about before. Thank you.
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sherber, I just want to confirm then that what you're asking for is to basically put you at a level similar to the other treatment facilities. And when we look at the other treatment facilities, we could all look at that and say that you guys are dramatically better as far as your success ratio. Is that correct?
Right. They're actually not. Maybe Dwayne would like to comment on this. The other facilities, these are not treatment facilities. These are basically boarding lodges that provide supplemental services, and I could get a copy of the, there are 14, I think, supplemental service requirements that basically you have to have I don't know what they could go through them. They're basic. But we do all of those. We're doing everything that our whole treatment program is doing. So we're doing what these facilities are getting county contracts for treatment on. But to answer your question, yes.
Yeah. Mr. Sherber, I heard one of the testifiers mention the Lord, which you know that's part of my personal life as well. But would you find that that is a key component in why you guys are so successful?
Mr. Sherber.
I believe it is. I think there's two major reasons why Teen Challenge is successful. Number one is that these guys will share prior to their coming in. We highlighted this on Friday night at a banquet. Prior to coming in, 99% of their peers were gang leaders and criminals and drug dealers and prostitutes. And we do work very close with the faith community. That's a key. They're our greatest allies. So when they leave the program, they have a mentoring group. They have an accountability. They have friends. That's super. They have friends in the faith community that will take them under their arm and help them get back on their feet. And then number two is the length of stay. I've got an article that was recently in Newsweek magazine, but I just want to highlight what they basically said in there. Let me just read this. It was a story of Ronnie Downey Jr., the whole addiction issue, but it says, in all recovery programs, the best predictor of success is length of treatment. While relapse is common, those who remain in at least a year or more are twice as likely to stay clean. The research shows about three-quarters of those who graduate from 12-month residential programs are employed, drug-free, and not in jail after 5 years. And so length is a key also.
Yeah. One last question. The reason I brought that up is I wanted to make sure that the reason for its success wasn't that you were from the Iron Range and came down there. And you know, I didn't want Representative Sotich or Rukavina to take credit for something unnecessarily.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Gazelka, maybe the reason for your success is because you're from the Iron Range, too.
Maybe.
Okay, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Todd, I thank you for bringing this forward. And Friday night was the first time that my husband and I had attended the banquet, and it is an incredible experience. So I really would encourage any of you to attend, especially if you have not. And Don and Jeff, I want to thank you for coming. My husband is a county attorney, and he said, I will never look at another drug addict the same way. So it was incredible, and I just wish you the best, and thank you, Pastor Sherber, for what
you
do.
Thank you.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I too, you know, I'm really, really impressed with the Teen Challenge program and following it over the years. It's exciting to see how successful you've been. I have a question, though, as far as, you know, you talked a little bit about the Duluth facility, and I noticed, you know, in this legislation here, it's specific to Hennepin County, and I'm just questioning, I guess, this is the first time I've ever been on, you know, associated with issues in this particular facility, but do we need to do something like this, too, for other counties, or how does that work?
That's a good question. We basically have taken a small bite. When we're starting the facility up in Duluth, which, by the way, the meth problem is absolutely epidemic in Duluth, and we've been, just so you know, I've been contacted by at least five, at the night of the banquet, we had at least six county attorneys were there, including Hennepin and Dakota County and Ramsey County, you name it, if we've had at least five different county attorneys and sheriff's departments contact us with starting teen challenges in southern Minnesota, Moorhead area, Grand Rapids, and this model could be reproduced over and over, but it's been basically we were given a building in Duluth and we were asked to start that, but we're just taking a small bite here. Out of 300 beds, or basically 250 adult GRH beds, we're asking for funding for 150 of them, and I haven't even touched Duluth because I know that there's not the money. But I'll be honest with you. I don't know if this don't go through. We've never turned anybody away, and I don't know what we can do. And I've looked at our program. Maybe we need to give these guys less counseling time, or less supervision, or let them on the street. But I can't cut back our programming, so I can't do this on what we're doing. And for when the teen program, we even mentioned, I got 50 teens. I don't get a nickel support for the teens, not one penny. So we subsidize every teen. We're raising almost $70,000 in donations. That means over $400,000 a month. And Representative Ruth, you were there. I mean, I had two businessmen Friday night came to the play and gave $1.5 million. But when you look at what it costs to run this thing, the ship is sinking unless I get some help. And when I look at what these other treatment programs are getting, and then we get $692, something's wrong here. And there is not a funding component for longer treatment. Everything I hear, the Attorney General, Congressman Oberstar, everybody's saying longer treatment, longer treatment, longer treatment. And so if it wasn't for GRH, there would be no funding component. So,
just some final words, Mr. Chair, members. Has bipartisan support, Representative Bradley said. We have some of the most conservative and some of the most liberal members as co-authors on this bill. So this is a small investment for a very good cause.
You have the final word, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions. And I love hearing this outpouring of support for long-term chemical dependency treatment. It's the only thing that works, and we know it. And actually, I have a bill, another bill. And this is going to be the day I'm going to say, why am I not getting hearing on my bills? Because we do know exactly what programs like yours can do if given enough time. Mm-hmm. And the bill I have is to put a dime a drink at the wholesale level to try to fund all of our programs so that we can have, adequate time. I mean, the chemical dependency programs have been cut back and back and back and back in recent years in terms of the length of time, and we know exactly what you said. So I hope people will remember that, and maybe you can help me get a hearing on my bill. Representative Smith told me yesterday he was going to decide today, so not too late, you can ask. That's worth funding for programs like. And I would ask you, Mr. Sherwood, maybe you could go up and see Representative Smith, and when you're done here, we could do it together. Mm. Otherwise, I don't know how we're going to have this kind of commitment to you and to others who are doing a very good job. I have a couple quick questions in that regard, Mr. Chairman. Apparently this money would come out of this budget, is that correct?
I would assume so, yes.
Mr. Chairman,
we have GRH in our...
Yeah, I have a question. Well, first of all, let me back up a bit. In terms of it coming out of this committee, again, I would like to bring a funding source to this legislature, and some of that should come to this committee then, if that's possible. I know that bill passed in the Senate. We just need to get it over here in the House. I do have a question, Mr. Sherbert. Is there a reason, since you're doing such a great job, that you're not going for the license with the county that would allow you to get paid for what you seem to be doing?
We do have a license program. We have a 60-day extended care program, but right now the window for those coming in, the 60-day program, you've got to be, you have to fail 30-day treatment. We don't have a 30-day, I'll tell you what, this is the honest truth. I've seen such failure with the 28-day programs, we don't even want to start one. And so I could get the 30 days, but there is no, after 60 days, there's no funding component.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reagan, you may be interested to know that there used to be. This was all done in the name of cost savings that programs were cut back to 28 days. Yeah. Even though we know it causes failure. So it's a resource, it's a finance issue. I'm very serious about, this is a very, very critical issue. We know, and one of the reasons I asked this in this community, we know it saves prison time, which is very much more expensive. And that's why it's a Representative Smith committee, I guess. And I'm happy that it is a public safety issue. A lot of you folks probably hung out in my neighborhood when you were doing your stuff by South Minneapolis, where the open drug market. And
we would really love to get people into Teen Challenge and other programs, but we know that to be successful, they need to have enough time in those programs, and we can't keep cutting them back, which we have done. So I guess if we were able to change the resources so that you could have a longer-term treatment, and all of our programs could have longer-term treatment that are successful, would that be something you'd be interested in applying for so we could get you a license in that regard?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I guess that's it. I guess I just couldn't miss the pitch. And Representative Dowell, thanks for bringing this bill. I assume, Mr. Sherlock, that the I guess it's tripling of the rate for GRH will be used. Will it just be used for whatever you describe as GRH, or will it be?
It's,
how will that be actually?
GRH is basically a board and lodge allotment.
Right.
Yeah, and with supplemental services, the supplemental services are that you have, you monitor their meds, that you have an admissions policy, and I could go through them. Yeah.
That's okay. I guess I'm just interested in if it allows you to. It goes into your budget and you can use it for what you want, apparently.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was out of the room when you first came down to testify, so I've got a couple of questions. You may have answered them already. We've heard a lot of the faith-based stuff. Do you have a... do you use a 12-step model also? Do you use... the group therapy model also, or is it all just, you know, get down on your knees and pray for deliverance?
We as I started to say, we have a licensed 60-day extended care program. Everyone going through that one-year program, even those who, we have about, at any time, about 40 people in the extended care 60-day program that are funded by the county. Everyone else, the 230 others, actually even in the teens, 300 others, go through the 60-day programming absolutely free at no cost to the government. So they're all, that's a program that's identical curriculum, it's the same, and it's been set up by the Department of Human Services. It's drug treatment, it talks about relapse prevention and pharmacology, everything that you'd have in a secular drug treatment program. And then in transitions from there, we have, Teen Challenge has its own, there's of these 172 centers have their own curriculum, but everything you'll find in a 12-step program is identical in Teen Challenge, except that this is a faith-based. We don't just say whatever higher power you want it to be. It is a Christian program, so we are very specific. We allow anyone to come in, any faith to come in. We have every Christian denomination represented in our program, and we've set this up with the Department of Human Services that. Basically, we want to be a Christian model. Is there a problem with that? They said there is no problem as far as licensing is concerned. We have Native American models. We have acupuncture models. We have all sorts of models. We need a faith-based Christian model. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So what about the agnostic?
Agnostic? He's allowed in. He can come in. He has to do our curriculum. In our programming, but the issue, and if you have any questions, you can sure contact the NASA Department of Health and Mr. Kruber and Mr. Brzezinski and those who have set up the licensing. But basically, I believe it's the same way that people would come into a Native American model, or they would come into a there's all different models of drug rehabilitation.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. So what about the recovering drug addict or alcoholic that has a screeching tree versus Jesus Christ or Muhammad or anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I want to share with this committee that I am not a Christian. And I decided to carry this bill because there is a need for those who believe in the Christian faith. And I think if we could duplicate this program in other faiths as well, I think it might be a good idea. But we're short on funds, and we still have a lot of work to do. And other groups deserve to get treatment
Any other discussion about this bill with the members? Seeing none, Representative Wilkin renews his motion to have House File 1741 laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you. Very well. Thank you very much for your company. Representative Nelson.
Good thing to come to a boil, but I fought against it.
It's a little too cool.
Representative Nelson, it's your desire to have this bill go to General Register, is that correct?
That's correct. It's currently on the floor in the Senate.
Move your bill.
Move the Senate to move the, 986 to the General Register.
Very well.
Stuff to get. What this bill does is there's an urban initiative program, which is a revolving loan fund, and this just opens up and makes a broader area that people can apply for this fund. Currently, it's Minneapolis, St. Paul, Anoka, Columbia Heights, Hopkins, Lauderdale, Lexington, Osseo, St. Anthony, and Spring Park, and West St. Paul. And this would include areas that would be included in it with the, if the bill passes, would be Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Richfield, and Bloomington, where there are concentrations of poverty. And I'll hand testimony over here to Eric Nathanson, who will describe the program. And
you want to put your amendment on it now or later?
I've got an amendment. Yeah, we can put the amendment on it now. I was asked to add this amendment to it. It's an A. It's the AO5 370 amendment. And what this does is sunsets a board, the UI board that we've been asked to get rid of. The commissioner of the department says that he needs one more committee or one more board that he has to serve on, and would ask that if he sunset it.
Very well. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Nelson renews his motion to have AO5-370 amendment be added to his 986 bill. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. It's the way you want.
Give a testifier here a chance to speak.
Please give your name for the record, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eric Nathanson. I'm the Financial Resources Coordinator for the Minneapolis Consortium of Community Developers, MCCD. My organization is one of eight nonprofit business development groups that operate as intermediaries for the state of Minnesota's Urban Initiative Program, UIP, which is operated by the Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED, lots of initials. Other organizations that participate in this program include Women Venture, the Neighborhood Development Center, and the African Development Center. We're all Twin City-based business development groups. As intermediaries, we partner with DEED to process small business loans, often for startup businesses, often for businesses from minority and new arrival communities that have challenges in accessing the commercial banking system. We process loans, we collect repayments, and we send these payments back to DEED so the program operates on a revolving loan fund basis. And because of this revolving nature, the new state funds are not needed to sustain the program. We make new loans out of the repayments from earlier loans, and this program goes back to the mid-90s. We also provide intensive technical assistance to our borrowers, which is something that they can't get from the private sector, and our overall goal is to move our business clients into the economic mainstream. Many of our clients are new arrivals who may come without a substantial credit history. They may not have sufficient equity to start the business, and they may need some training that we can provide them. Last year, our group facilitated about $1.6 million in financing. As Representative Nelson indicated, under the existing statute, the program is limited primarily to the central cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but there are some suburban jurisdictions that are included. But many suburban communities with significant minority and new arrival communities are not eligible because they don't meet the existing eligibility standard in the statute. So the bill before you, House File 986, establishes a new eligibility formula that recognizes targeted areas within the larger suburban communities. And as President Nelson indicated, the bill would extend eligibility to businesses in Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, Crystal, New Hope, St. Louis Park, Ridgefield, Bloomington, Fidley, and South St. Paul. The bill does not require additional state funds. It merely enables intermediate organizations like my group to use their existing state allocations in these broader areas. And because we've been able to use the state funds to leverage the substantial private money, we can do more loans basically with the same amount of money. Those of us that also operate in the central cities are able to draw on some local funds. We've actually gotten an increase in our local funding allocation. So we can do more loans in the city of Minneapolis and also expand into these new areas. So that's a brief overview of 986, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Any questions? Seeing none, Representative Nelson renews his motion to have House File 986 as amended be passed and sent to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion passed. Thank you very much. Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sturgis.
I'd like to move House File 762 be recommended to pass and move wherever Representative Kelleher wants it to go.
Where would you like it to go?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question.
Does it have any fiscal impact?
The fiscal note is shows that there's no fiscal impact. It is currently laying in the Senate in the early childhood for possible inclusion in the early childhood bill. Just so
that's the Education Committee.
Yeah.
Would you like this referred to the Education Committee? Or would you like it?
Sure.
Okay. That's what we'll do.
That's my motion then, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That's Ed Finance, is that correct?
I think that's
too late
really
for policy committee. Very well. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing House File 762 today, mental health screening bill. And this is an important bill as a tool in the toolbox as we deal with truant children. And currently we have a statute on truancy that you have before you because we are amending that section of law. What is happening here is that 1 in 10 children are affected by this issue. It's an issue that we can't ignore. When mental illness is untreated, it can lead to absenteeism and poor outcomes in school. I think we've seen that on a number of occasions, sometimes in our own families and sometimes in the larger public. This bill moves us in a direction that at least gives the option to school districts and to parents to be aware that when you have a truant child, that this is something that should be looked at. And today I have a couple of testifiers and give their testimony to you as well.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank
give your name
you.
To the record.
I'm Sue Abderholden. I'm the Executive Director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Minnesota, and we are clearly in support of this bill. You know, it used to be that students who skipped school did so on a lark, but in this era, it no longer means that. It really has some very serious problems. These students fall behind in their schoolwork, and it's often easier to drop out than to catch up. Truancy, we've learned, is a stepping stone to delinquent and criminal activity. Students who are truant are at a higher risk of being drawn into behavior involving drugs, alcohol, or violence. And truancy may often be the first step towards a lifetime of unemployment, crime, and incarceration. Truancy costs schools dollars because they don't receive dollars when students aren't there. Truancy costs businesses because they have to train uneducated workers, and it costs taxpayers who pay higher taxes for law enforcement and for welfare costs. when researchers look at why students are truant, they point out to family health issues, financial demands, substance abuse, or mental health problems. The National School Safety Center identified 5 primary elements of a comprehensive community and educational strategy to combat truancy. They include involving parents in all prevention activities, ensuring that students face firm sanctions, creating meaningful incentives for parental responsibility, establishing ongoing truancy prevention programs in schools, and addressing the unique needs of each child, and consider developing initiatives to combat the root causes of truancy. The Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention partnered with the Department of Education to develop best practices in preventing truancy. All of the models that they promote emphasize the need to intensively monitor, counsel, and strengthen families. Project Thrive in Oklahoma City carries out a number of activities, including making referrals for mental health services. Atlantic County in New Jersey also refers families for psychiatric services. And another one called Act Now, and a program in Galveston, Texas, make sure that they collaborate with mental health professionals. So one of the services they provide is mental health screening. What we're requesting in this bill is that truancy programs look at one of the possible underlying causes of truancy, untreated and undiagnosed mental illness. Screening tools are a very good way of flagging children who may have a mental health problem. Screening tools are not diagnostic assessments. They simply tell us if there are things that we might want to look into further. All the research tells us that truancy leads to delinquency. And all the research tells us that an overwhelming percentage of young people in the juvenile justice system have a mental illness. So knowing this, why not address the mental health issues earlier? There are no mandates in this bill. It simply plants the seeds for truancy programs in schools to perhaps conduct a mental health screening to see if there's anything further that they need to refer people to. You remember 2 years ago we asked that schools screen children when they have, when they've been suspended for 10 days or more. We didn't mandate it, we just suggested it, and we are seeing schools do that, and they are identifying children earlier. So we would just ask that you support this legislation.
Very well. I think Representative Gazelle has got a question.
I can wait if they want to.
You want to finish your presentation, then we'll ask questions.
Maybe our other testifier.
Anything for you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
My name is Eva Newbeck. I come before you today as a school social worker with 35 years of experience, and to tell you that there's nothing new under the sun about truancy. You've heard it all before. For sure, there are those students who skip some classes or whole days because, as they say, they just want to have some fun. But the vast majority of school truants are students with varying degrees of mental illness or who have other mental health issues. My latest case was last week when an 11th grade truant student was diagnosed with depression and anxiety. I'm not exaggerating when I say nearly every day of my practice, I get involved with a new student whose education is being compromised by mental health issues. Kids who aren't happy can't cope. They perform academically below their potential. They know what they should be able to do, but can't. The more their ability and performance are discrepant, the more likely they are to be truant. And that is to give up and ultimately leave school. You know what I see in my work all the time? ADHD and ADD for sure, but more and more depression, anxiety, eating disorders. Yesterday, a boy of mine was admitted to a hospital, a boy that is, for eating disorders, suicide ideation, and lots of learning disabilities that don't meet the criteria for special education. The county asks us social workers to notify parents after 3 absences from class, and then the 7 absences to refer them to court. Quite frankly, I don't have that kind of time, and I don't know anybody who does. I look for patterns. I rely on parents and teachers to red flag the kids in need. When I get involved, that is to case manage them, I spend many hours screening using my professional skills to determine a course of action. Initially, parents want to minimize the problems about truancy. They don't want their children labeled. Often they choose to have their student and themselves suffer too long before they accept any help. Because psychiatry and psychology and social work are imperfect sciences, there's hesitancy to pursue professionals in these areas, like myself. The stigma around mental illness and mental health is powerful, and deters families from getting the help they need in school. Most kids really want to go to school. When they can't get themselves out of bed for days or get out of the house or avoid a class repeatedly because they think their classmates don't like them or skip the day of a test because they're afraid to fail. Do these sound like healthy students? Not according to my manual. And with every additional skipped class, the problem gets compounded. In my current position at South High School in Minneapolis, I see young people becoming more independent and learning to cope with the pressures and stresses of a more demanding education. Most kids handle it well through trial and error, learned strategies, resilience, and mental health. Those who struggle are not willful in their failure. When I interview their families, I typically find a history of mental illness, a father with depression, an uncle with agoraphobia, and an aunt with eating disorder, or a grandparent who has committed suicide, or yesterday, a mother with bipolar. There are early warning signs that can be read even at the elementary school level. If young students could be screened and treated early, there would be a much better chance of them being able to attend school and perform according to their ability. I feel lucky at South High, I have to tell you, because I'm working with a group of students, they call themselves the Silver Ribbon Campaign. They designed this particular group to support students and families and friends who suffer from mental illness. This group of students has raised the level of awareness of students, families, and staff, making our school a community, a place where students aren't judged by their state of mental health. But now, because mental illness is not such a closeted issue, my work is more intense. Truancy and mental illness are not just going to go away. We need to do mental health screening in cases involving truancy so that we can get to the underlying causes and then work with the family to find appropriate resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gazilka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can see where this would be helpful, and I'm just curious, when you identify a student, then mental health screening is offered? Is that how it goes? And I guess what I'm wondering is what kind of questions are asked and how do you get the parents involved then once you identify someone?
Mr. Chairman, we always underscore that screening is voluntary and that you need to involve parents in this. Some of the screening tools actually are filled out by parents who note the child's behavior. Often they know the child best. If you look in the legislation, what we're doing is actually notifying parents that they could have a mental health screening and letting the truancy centers know that this could be a part of the services that are offered to families. So this is not something where you pull the child aside, you know, do some secret things and, you know, go off and get some treatment. But this really, it has to involve the family because they know the child's behaviors very well, along with, you know, perhaps some close teachers or the social worker and things like that.
Representative Kazuki.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and specifically then you would also maybe let the parent know that one of the reasons that truancy can occur or homework not coming in is mental health issues and you should get this checked out. Something along those lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. You know, there's a whole number of things that you know, lead to truancy, and sometimes it's chemical dependency, sometimes it's a mental health issue. Sometimes children, young people, frankly, are using alcohol to self-medicate. And so, you know, you want to try to catch all those things, nip it in the bud, so to speak, yeah, so that you don't have to use more intensive and, frankly, costly services.
Yeah. Representative Westbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had the same question, but in addition to that, too, as far as in the bill, you know, it says that including it, the health screening may be available. The cost of the screening itself, who picks that up? Is that the parent or the school if in fact, you do decide to have one of these?
Mr. Abraham.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, some screening tools are actually free off the Internet. The pediatric checklist, which has been, you know, validated numerous times, is something that you can actually download, fill out. That's what we had suggested when we passed the bill about doing the screening for kids who've been suspended for 10 days or more. Some of the tools, if they're a little bit more intensive, can actually be paid for through private insurance. There's actually a bill going through the Senate right now to have Medicaid funds pay for a mental health screening when you want to do a screening that's a little bit more intensive. So there's kind of a range of screening documents that can be used. We've not heard from schools since the last legislation was passed in terms of the suspension issue that they have found, had a problem finding tools that were inexpensive, free, or low cost.
Okay, and then just follow on that, the mental health screening, assuming that this test is done, is that at the option of the parent or is that the school's option?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is absolutely the option of the parents. It's the option that we want them to know is available. And again, this isn't an assessment. It doesn't mean that you take the screening tool, you take it, and then you have an assessment. What it does is kind of raise red flags. You may go through the checklist and say, well, you know, it doesn't look like there's anything there. You may go through and say, no, you've got 19 of the 20 questions. You know, you really might want to take your child in to a mental health professional and look at this further. So it really is just kind of a way to filter out some kids who may be at higher risk of having a mental illness.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative,
one more question. Representative Kelleher, in the bottom of page 2, it talks about some increased school responses could include classroom modifications and accommodations. What are you thinking there? What type of modifications and accommodations are referenced as possible things to make this bill better?
Just Adler.
Mr. Chairman, I
forget that. It's a good German name, isn't it?
Well, it's actually Gwith.
Well, that's probably like a little bit of a problem.
I mean, I joke that it took so long for me to say it that I didn't change my name when I got married. But anyway,
at least
one,
it's not Croatian.
One of the things that when we look at classroom accommodations for kids who have a mental health diagnosis, they may not meet the level of needing a 504 plan in special education. Actually, a lot of kids with depression and anxiety don't. But there are classroom accommodations that can be made that can actually really help a child stay in school and be successful. One of them is, frankly, test time. When you have a child who has really, really high anxiety, it's kind of hard to imagine, but, I mean, we're talking about kids who start almost hyperventilating, totally black out, just can't, you know, do anything. And those are the days that they skip school so they don't have to take the test. Just telling the child that you can take as much time as you need. Often they end up not taking any more time, but just knowing that can reduce the anxiety. Sometimes kids who have a serious depression may want to have an opportunity to have a place where they can go to really collect themselves or be able to call a parent or their counselor when they need to. As an example, my daughter had serious depression in middle school, and I want to say that she's doing really well now. But when she had it, we didn't have a 504 plan. We didn't have special education or anything that. We made accommodations, and the school was willing to work with me on that. She could, for instance, when she was getting really anxious or feeling really depressed, she had permission to use the school phone at any time to contact me, and then I could work with her kind of to work with it and make it for the rest of the day. There were other times when if she was, you know, starting to feel really upset, she could simply go to the counselor's office and just kind of check in. The counselor would kind of beef her up a little bit, and she'd go back to the classroom. So they're pretty simple accommodations that can be made for kids who have a mental illness that isn't high enough to get a 504 plan.
Mr. Chair, so then there's like timeout areas type things, being sent to the cloakroom or something or that type of thing. It's not expensive modifications.
Mr. Chairman, no. We're not talking expensive modifications at all. We're not talking about an absolute right because it's not a 504 plan or special education. But just for schools to think about maybe some of the accommodations that we could make that really help these kids stay in school.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fundamental idea, I have no problem. I like it. But my first question is, there would be nothing to stop. This is all just permissive. So people could do it today. So then, if that being the case, what's the purpose of the legislation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, I think actually it's somewhat interesting how this legislation came to me as part of our work together in the bipartisan, multi-body Mental Health Caucus. And so that's how I came upon this legislation and my previous service on a board that deals with mental health issues. So I want to tell you a little bit by way of background to tell you that what this does, like the whole statute, is it gives parents sort of the roadmap of if your child is truant, where maybe you want to be looking for the issues that contribute to truancy. So I think that what we're doing here, and Representative Bradley, I know you probably know this, that sometimes what you're dealing with a family history of mental illness. Sometimes you're dealing with a situation where there's no family history of mental illness, and so people may not have had the moment where they say, gosh, I had no idea that truancy could be linked to a mental health issue. So I think we can see all the whole range of these things, but this is very clear in the notice that has to go to parents that says this might be one possibility. It doesn't say it is the thing. It adds to the notice. And so I think that that's a helpful thing as we raise awareness around mental health issues.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kelleher, thank you. I mean, I assume, but I think it's important because this is about raising the level of awareness, and that's very commendable and very important to do. Then let me move on to the other one. I'm trying to figure out the fiscal note. I just got caught in one myself on a fiscal note where all I did was sort of something in terms of screening, and I got scored for extra expense because they believed that it would result in additional people being served. Now, that's not necessarily altogether bad. I'm a little surprised in the Department of Human Services side here that there isn't some scoring. If we screen, we're going to find some people who need services, and some proportion of those people are going to be public assisted candidates. And I'm not asking for trouble, but it does seem to me a little bit strange, and I'm not asking necessarily for it to come to Health and Human Services, because I looked at that section, and it says we don't see any. Maybe just for the record, I just want to make sure that the chair of the Finance Committee for the Health Committee has looked at it. It says no cost. It's another miracle.
Mr. Chair, I'm probably as surprised as you are, but I think that because it's so permissive, and I think the assumption here is likely that so many of these tools are available that are free to no cost, as well as looking at if a further screening needs to happen, they're often kin to the private insurance option as well. So I looked through it as well. I read it when I was sitting in the audience and pleasantly surprised. So,
Stu, if I just could include in that, if it were earlier in the session, I think I still, just for a matter of giving visibility to the idea, would probably call it to my committee because I think it's the kind of things we should be talking about. But given where we are in the session time frame, I'm not going to do that, and I wish you well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any problem with the idea here. It's probably a good idea to let parents know that assessment's available. Is there anything to notify the parents of the results?
Representative.
Of the screening.
Ms. Adler Holden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, I mean, that's when you look at what they're doing, especially with the community-based project, they're always meeting on truancy issues. They're always meeting with the parents about all of these kinds of things. Especially if the parents are involved in doing the checklist, they would be, they have to be a part of it to be able to talk about that. It just frankly never occurred to me that you wouldn't share it because that's important information for families to know.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
it's not clear to me from reading this that the parent would necessarily be involved in the screening, that the parents might just give permission for the school to do the screening with the child. And as you may know, under current law, the parents don't necessarily get access to the results.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything to notify parents of that fact?
Let's see. Mr. Chairman, I'm quickly looking at the legislation. I think it's clearer in the community-based action projects because they do talk about coordinating with students and their families.
Mr. Chairman, it's you're not going to find it in this piece of legislation, but in another area of law, it basically says the parent doesn't need to be told the results or be involved. And I have issues with that part of legislation, as some of the people around the table might know, and with 3 minutes left, we probably don't have time to get into that, but that's a real concern of mine, and if we're going to let parents know that the screenings are available, and I'm not going to move an amendment now, but we should also let them know that if they give permission for that screening, that they may not have permission to see the results. I think that's important, because I think it's a real travesty in law that the parents aren't allowed to get involved in that, in seeing the results and helping their child when their child needs help.
Isn't this one of the goals that you have, is to get parents involved in everything that you, for their kids?
Absolutely. There's not a discussion that's ever that omits parents from the equation. They're the ones that have to follow through on any referrals, any work that gets done with the students, so it's not something that the school can do alone.
I would think the more parental involvement, the easier your job is.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I will make a commitment to Representative Wilkin and others that as it moves forward, we'll have council look at it. I understand the section of law he's talking about. I think we need to talk about it, whether I believe that this is fairly clear in what it's doing in notice of intent to parents. I don't know if you want to amend a different section of law, if I really want to do that in this bill. So I guess we have to have a discussion about that.
Very well. Any other questions? Representative Sloan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keller, and I just want to ask for your comment on this. You know, if you've heard me at other committees, I talk about this, that the school my son is going to has a 62% graduation rate from special education, which I think is terrible. And I think that graduation rates are the predecessor is truancy. Obviously, yeah. And why do kids stop going to school? And what we hear about special education in high schools is sometimes it's just holding tanks where kids are kind of just waiting to see if they're going to graduate or not, or go to VOTEC, or what's going to happen. And part of, I think this is a good bill. I think it gets at the tip of the iceberg, but I think there's big problems here with our schools. There's big problems with truancy. There's big problems with graduation rates, and mental health is part of it. But I think if you take a slice of the special ed class, there is going to be a lot of kids with all those problems you talk about. And really, shouldn't you? Are you going, is this the best solution?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, I wish I could tell you I was here to solve those problems single-handedly. I'm not. I struggle every day with looking at where we are in our public education system. It's a good system, but it also has its flaws, and you raise a flaw of when we look at our success rate with kids who are in special education, but you could look at those success rates with a lot of different demographics in the public schools. I think that this is one tool in the toolbox for parents when kids are truant. And I do know that this is an important thing to both parents and educators. I happen to be working with someone who may be running for county attorney in Hennepin County right now. And when we were having conversations with people over the weekend, the number one thing that came up was my current county attorney's work on truancy, that it's a good start, but it's not finished yet. And so I would tell you that in terms of what's happening with this bill, you are right. This is a start. This is not the fix-all, end-all, be-all to do these things. My shoulders are hurting already from the burden that we carry as public policymakers to try to solve these problems, but this is one little step that I think we can provide an opening to parents to raise awareness that this may be part of the issue.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Sertich renews his motion to have House File 762 be passed and referred to
Education Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I have a complaint to register today. One of our committee members has a 30th wedding anniversary today and did not choose to bring a cake or cookies or donuts to celebrate with. You know, all of
our censor.
I think an ethics committee hearing should be heard. But I'd like to offer my congratulations to his wife, Kathy, who's in the audience, for putting up with a carpenter for that many years.
As do I. Congratulations.
Yeah.
And we can remediate that little faux pas of not bringing treats. We have two committees tomorrow. So, with that, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.